This is a by God podium. Look at that. That's a big one. I'm Gary, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here, I think. I thank you now, so I don't forget. I want to thank you all now for inviting me to come. I'm serious. These things are a privilege, and I'm delighted to be in Salt Lake City. My dry date is the third day of December, 1964. And that was the day that I entered the nut house in Evanston, Wyoming. I had been born in Cheyenne, and I tried my very best to grow up there and failed miserably. And that's where a large part of my experiences around alcoholism began. And I guess I better find my own clock here. Get you all home before breakfast. I was born on an experimental farm outside of Cheyenne. They experimented with plants and trees and stuff. I was not an experiment. And the only reason my home was dysfunctional was account of me. My parents got along and stayed together until they died. And, you know, it was a good home. I had everything. It should have been right for me to grow up and be a good kid. But as a kid in school, as a youngster, as a kid growing up, and I can't give you ages and stuff like that, but nothing was ever quite right. If we had guests in our house, it wasn't my house. It wasn't right. I was a kid in school that did everything I could do to not have any attention drawn to me. Because if I had to go up to the blackboard to do something, I couldn't do it. My knees would knock, and it would just—I just couldn't talk, and I couldn't do those things. And it seemed like the older I got, the worse it got. And so the time I reached the junior high years and that sort of thing, I noticed all the other guys could talk to girls, and it looked like a really good idea to me. I would really have liked to have done that, but I just couldn't get the guts together to do it. And that kind of gives you an idea. I hated school. Hated being around people I didn't know, and I didn't like a whole lot of people I did know. So I was a problem from the start. And I hadn't really thought about it until recently, but somewhere in there, I learned about lying. And I think that was really before anybody tried to get me socialized with other people. That's something that came natural to me. And then, of course, as I got older and got to drinking, I got better at it, I think. So there was something inherently dishonest, if you will, I think was what was going on with me. I'm looking back at that from now, so I just thought I'd throw that out there. What caused me to think it recently is we have a young granddaughter, we call her. She is actually my wife's and my great-granddaughter, but my daughter ended up adopting her granddaughter. So I went from great-grandparent to grandparent and didn't lose a year of age. I haven't figured that out. And that's another Jerry Springer story. I won't go into that. Anyway, the first time I got a hold of enough to drink that changed my life and gave me that answer to all those things I just told you about, I was 16 years old, and two other fellows and myself had driven from Cheyenne to Laramie to go to the state basketball tournament. And when we got there, Bob and Kenny picked up a couple of girls. Remember, I couldn't talk to them. I was glad to see they were in the car, but I was kind of a lump. And then we went and got some guy to get us a quart of Four Roses whiskey and some Coke. That Coca-Cola. You got to explain that anymore. And we took off for the boondocks with the girls in the car and the booze in the car. Looking back on it a few years later, it struck me that we had the girls in the car and the booze in the car and didn't know what to do with either one. You couldn't go to the drugstore and buy the magazines that explained it all like you can now. So that was. But we passed the bottle around, and I did it like I'd watched the Cowboys do it the first time. You know, they pop the top and wipe it off for some damn reason, take a drink and pass it on. And then it came around again, and I tipped it up, and I kept it there until they took it away from me. And I got a hold of a bunch of whiskey, and it was wonderful. I kid you not, it was the answer I had been looking for 16 years. I no longer felt like I didn't belong with that group in that car. Hell, I felt like I owned that group in that car. It was dynamite. And I could talk to the girls. In fact, I made a grab at one of the girls. Failed miserably, but I felt good about the grab. And and apparently I was getting out of line, so they took me to the truck stop to get me to drink some coffee to sober me up. Well, we all know that doesn't sober you up, but it woke me up. And I took a poke at a big cowboy, and he slapped me around real good. And then they found a place to put me for the night. And they told me the chronology of all that the next day, and I didn't remember much of it, but I verified everything I told you before I'd quit telling it. And apparently what I've just told you was true. And I tell that story because that's the whole story of my social drinking. That's as good as it ever got. There were all. I'm serious. I don't recall ever going out around drinking without having those same three goals in mind: to get drunk, have a woman, maybe get in a fight. I mean, generally the getting drunk and whatever happened next precluded the third, but it was that was my line. I chased that feeling I had that night until I couldn't get it anymore. And then I chased it harder. And that didn't take me long. See, I was a sophomore in high school then. And at that point in time, I tried to do everything that I did that alcohol was involved. And at 16 years old in Cheyenne, that really wasn't all that difficult because there were some places you could go and they would sell us booze if we could see over the bar. But it got more difficult for me to get things done. I hated school. I didn't want to go to school. My dad had made it extremely clear that I was going to finish school. One day he said to me, he says, "Gary, you're going to finish school. If we even have to move into town so you don't have so far to walk when you get old, you're by God going to finish school." And so I knew I had to do that. And so that's what I did. I did just what it took to finish. I didn't do a thing more. Extra credit was for the fools. I didn't do that. I just wanted out. So that day come, my experience with girls there in high school after I started drinking was effectively limited to meeting a girl who I accused her of having picked me up at a pond that they ice skated on out at Lyons Park. And she tells me it was in the springtime, there wasn't any ice, and we met on this big old steam engine they have parked out the park. And one of us is right. Take your own pick. I don't care. You know who's right, don't you? It ain't me. But she and I, we have effectively been together since then. I was 16 and she was 15. Now, there have been many periods or timeouts for bad behavior from then until to now, but we're still together. This summer we'll be married 50 years. And just to kind of throw that out. And so anything I'm telling you here either includes her directly or indirectly, obviously, for the entire time we were through that. So I'm a year ahead of her in school, and so I'm out of school quicker, and I joined the Army, and it took me 6 months in a court-martial for my military career. And I'm back in Cheyenne, and the day I get back, I call the high school, and I tell the office that I'm her dad, and there's been an emergency in the family. I'd like to pick her up at the north door of the school, and off we went, and that's where I went. We got married the following September of her senior year, after her senior year of school. In January, we had an 8.5-pound premature baby girl. And Now, only the older people laugh at that. Younger people said, what in the hell is he talking about? What's he saying? They don't get it. So anyway, we promptly had three little girls. I went through job after job after job. One of those jobs was driving a semi from Cheyenne to the other side of Tooele to a naval depot where I filled it up with government surplus stuff and took it back to Cheyenne, and on the way back I delivered. And I remember a couple instances that I would be on my way back and be getting late, and so I'd stop here in Salt Lake and find a place to park that trailer and take a big semi-tractor downtown looking for bars. And back in whatever that was, I guess it would have been about 63, 62, I had a little difficulty finding the bars, but I'm a good alcoholic. I found them. And somehow I drank in Salt Lake City and didn't get in a lick of trouble. And I don't understand that. It's one of the few instances of my life that I went in and got as drunk as I could and still could navigate back to where the trailer was. And probably slept in the truck and hooked it up and left in the morning. By the time I was 24 years old, a month before my 25th birthday, I was 6 foot 2 inches tall. I weighed something less than 130 pounds. I was skinny. I was dying. Walked fast. My legs whistled. I was so skinny. I had been in a. I had run out of bars. In that process, down in Cheyenne, it doesn't take long. There's not that many bars, but the ones I could go to were getting fewer and fewer. And so I went to a bar I hadn't been to before. And I was in real trouble that morning. I was sick. But I did what I always did. I walk in there, and this was the day of counter checks, and I walked in, and I'd say, give me a check, and they'd say, which bank? And it didn't matter. I didn't have an account in any banks. And But I wrote a bad check for $5, and all I ordered was a beer. For what it's worth, those of you that care, that means I got $4.65 back in change after this order of beer. So that was a long time ago, wasn't it? What does a beer cost these days? I have no idea. Don't care now, I think about it. And it took a while to get it down. Because what I would do normally in the morning is, that wasn't unusual for me to write a bad check to start drinking. But normally I had to get that drink down, and that may take two or three to get one to stay. And then I'd finally start feeling a little better. The hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it felt like it might die down. And then I'd take another one and I'd feel a little bit better, maybe 10%. And then I'd go for a while and I'd get to thinking, one more drink and I'm going to catch my edge. I'm going to be whoever I want to be and it's going to work. And I could pick the girls up and everything's going to be just right. And I'd take that drink and boom, I'd pass it. Is gone. Missed it completely. That happened and happened and happened again. And then towards the end, I was having the experience of drinking and drinking and drinking, and nothing was happening. I couldn't get drunk. And that was the most disappointing thing I ever said. Now, we both know that had I been stopped by the cops and they'd have had me blowing a breathalyzer, I'd have been way up there. I was clearly drunk. But nothing changed here. It had stopped completely. I can't honestly tell you that was the day that I took my, that happened the day I took my last drink, but I had done that. I'd written a $5 check at that. Played some liar's poker with some other early risers in the bar. Then I was asked to leave. And so I went back to the bar that I thought they would let me back in. And at that point, I'd won some money so I could go back and buy back some of my bad checks. And I went in there, I bought them back. And they suggested that I leave right after I did that. They didn't even give me time to take a drink. I had been booted out of the house. I had been asked to leave, and I had moved in with the Ham's beer distributor, which I thought was a remarkable move. But, a couple of days later, he didn't think it was so slick, and he asked me to leave. So I didn't have anywhere to go, and so I called Julie and said I wanted to come in and see the kids. And she said, come on in. And so I thought it had worked. I thought, man, I'm back home. What's going to happen? And when I got in there, her dad was there, and we had that talk. Y'all know about that talk, don't you? We've had lots of those talks. And it was something about the kind of drinking I'd done and what was I going to do about it. And I'm just numb. I'm just sitting there kind of nodding my head, you know. Another thing they knew to do with alcoholics at that time in 1964 was to send them to Evanston. Julie's dad had an uncle that had been in there 3 or 4 times. In fact, he died on the way up for the last time. He went into DTs and convulsions and died in the pickup as they were hauling him up there on his last trip. That was after I got sober. And so that was all we knew to do. And would I go up there? And I said to her dad, I says, yeah, if you'll take me. Hell, it's only 400 miles. That didn't seem unreasonable. And he said, well, I'll get you on a bus to go on up there. And so that's what's happened. I actually got on that bus. He bought me the ticket. I got on that bus, and all I got off for was to stop in Rock Springs and get a pint to finish the ride. And I got there. And let me flash forward a few years after that. I was sober, and Julie and I were living in Denver, and the girls, and Thanksgiving dinner. And her dad says, Gary, do you remember the night that you went to the nut house? I said, yeah, a little bit. I said, why? He says, I didn't much care which bus you got on, just as long as it was leaving Cheyenne. That was the only one. And so, but I got there. And briefly, I was there for 16 weeks. I learned I was an alcoholic there by looking at the old U-shaped Jelinek charts. You remember those? Any of those have been in the jitter joints? They still use them in various stages of alcoholism as you go down it. And at the bottom, there's DTs and convulsions and death and all that. And if you survive the death, there's various stages of what they call recovery stages going up. And I remember checking them off when I went down there, and I thought, I'll be damned. Because I went right down to the bottom. The only difference was I was still breathing in and out. They locked me up in solitary for a while in a room that had a little glass window in the door. And you'd look up there, and every once in a while you'd see somebody's nose smashed up against looking back in at you. And I guess you're looking to see if you're still alive or they need to come clean it up or what. But then they looked me out, and they put me up in an alcoholic ward. And I was by far the youngest person in there. And the best guess looking back on that, back in 1964, I was probably the youngest alcoholic in AA in Wyoming. Not that that matters a hell of a lot, but it just kind of gives you a clue. Where I was with all these older guys. And I went to my first AA meeting in there. It was a program of attraction. The attraction was if I didn't go to the meeting, I had to go to a different ward. And that other ward had people on it that I didn't want to be around. So I was attracted to AA. And I remember a piece of the first meeting. I don't remember what was said there, but I remember they marched us down there early, and I mean looking between the bars, and we could see out in the parking lot as cars were driving into it. And I told the guy standing next to me, I said, Joe, they can't be alcoholics. And he said, oh, yeah, why is that? I said, look at their cars. They got chrome strips on both sides. One-piece windshields, both headlights. They weren't anything like the cars I'd been driving. They came in and whatever they talked. In fact, some people drove up from near here, and I always thought somebody came up from Salt Lake, but to go to that meeting. But all I remember is I talked about God, and my mind grew shut there for a while because I had never heard that kind of conversation. I learned the Lord's Prayer in the nut house in the AA meetings. It wasn't a part of my growing up, unless you were cussing, then you heard about God. Somewhere in there, I got dried out enough that some things started to change. I can't tell you which week it was or anything else. I would go to their therapy sessions, and I learned to say what they wanted just to say. We get good at that, don't we? You lock us up behind 4 walls, and we'll learn to say stuff. We catch right on and to make it as easy as we can for it. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not, but we'll say it. And that's what I was doing. But we're sitting down in the canteen, just, you know, round tables with maybe 8 chairs around them. A few of us are sitting down there talking, drinking coffee one time, and probably telling a lie. When the guys there with me are talking about what they're going to do when they get out. Now, I had understood at that point, let me back up just a minute. I not only, the doctor's opinion made sense to me in the nut house. If you've not read the doctor's opinion, I suspect you should do it. You'll find out right now you're an alcoholic like I am, and that's a real alcoholic. And the bottom line of that is that I have no way to keep myself from drinking, save being locked up in somewhere in the desert or something like that to maybe keep me from drinking. As much as I don't want to drink, you can't keep me from drinking. I can't keep myself from drinking. I can't do it. And once I start, I can't stop until I get stopped. You know, and I got stopped by running out of money. I got stopped by wrecking the car. I got stopped by smacking a cop. That'll buy a guy to get you off whiskey and hurt. I would get stopped before I would stop. I couldn't do anything about it. And I felt horrible about all the promises I made that I'd never do it again. Never take a drink again. And never made it a day. I don't remember that promise ever made it a whole day. It didn't do it. I don't think it made it to noon most days. So anyway, I understood being powerless over alcohol. I had that pretty clear. And I'm sitting down there drinking coffee with these guys, and they're talking about what they're going to do when they get out. And I remember one of them was talking about going back to Fort Bridger and try to get the ranch back. And then another one wanted to get back out in the oil patch and get to making money again. The other one wanted to get his family back or the business back or whatever it was. And I remember sitting there thinking that I'm in a room full of has-beens, and then it struck me that I was a never-was. I had never done anything. And it seemed to be my turn to talk. And when it got around to me, and they were sitting there looking at me, and I said, I don't have a clue what I'm going to do when I get out here. I don't have any idea. All I know is I don't ever want to take another drink. I met the requirements of the third tradition that night, I do believe. Didn't know that, but I think I did. And it's like I heard myself say that. Honest, I had never had that thought before in my life that I didn't ever want to take a drink before that instant. And I knew it was true. And then shortly behind that in there, I understood that probably my only chance for that to happen that I had to hang around by people like you if I wanted to live. And I don't mean anything beyond breathing in and out if I wanted to live. I knew I was dying when I hit there. I was really sick. And I'd taken some beatings, and I was fortunate to survive some of them. My dentist today looks in my mouth and says, my God, what did you run into? Because there are broken teeth, missing teeth. There's not a tooth in there that doesn't have something right there just to hold it together, because I kept getting in front of the wrong guys. And this just happened. They let me out of there after 4 months, and I had a place to go. If I had a free ride to college, they came and offered me a free ride to college, or I had to go look for a job. What would you do? Took a bus back to Cheyenne and got off the bus, and I just had the thought, when I got off the bus in Evanston to walk up to the hospital, I got off that bus and I looked at that old granite building up on the hill. I always thought that'd be a great opening scene for a horror movie, to look up there in that old nunna. But somebody nodded their head over there. Was that you that seen that? And a cop came up to me and he said, are you going up there? How do you know? I said, yeah. And he gave me a ride up. And I got off the bus in Cheyenne 16 weeks later. It's 2 or 3 in the morning. Bus station in Cheyenne at 2 or 3 in the morning. Trust me, there's nothing going on. Except old Lloyd Guy and this old detective that I had any number of acquaintances with growing up in Cheyenne is standing in there. And he comes up to me. He said, need a ride, Gary? And I says, yeah. And he says, you going over to Bailey's? That was Julie's dad's house. And I said, yeah. He said, well, come on. We get in the car, and all Lloyd said to me that whole trip is, Gary, you know, some people really shouldn't drink. And so I said, so you know where I've been? He says, I've known where you've been since you were 14 years old. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out. He did me a wonderful favor, and he really did. And he showed up at the cop shop because nothing was going on, and he must have figured I was coming to the bus station and figured I was coming home that day. Never seen him again. I spent 3 years in Laramie. I did 4 years of college in three. The AA in Laramie was a meeting on Monday and a meeting on Friday if somebody else showed up. And I went to every one of them. I don't think I missed any. And I listened to what they said. And I tried to go to college, and I had the hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it every day. It was awful. I still suffered from untreated alcoholism, even though I had been through what they thought was one of the best professional treatment centers at the time. Now, there couldn't have been a whole hell of a lot of them in 64, but that was it. I'd watched the guy that founded the program there in Evanston drink while I was there. And then they buried my counselor a few months after I left because he got to drinking around his gold mine and fell down it. And he was down there with all kinds of empty bottles when they finally found him. They found him by the smell. He'd been there a long time. And still I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew exactly what Dr. Selsworth was talking about. I don't know why I didn't drink. The pain was as bad then as it had ever been. The worst thing you can do to me as an alcoholic is take the alcohol away and expect me to get along without something else. Alcohol, when we're drinking, we're pretty good people. When we got problems, it's when we're not drinking, isn't it? That's it. Sometimes I don't think the professionals understand that. They had any clue what was going on inside us when we're not drinking. Wonder what I said. It's not the first time that happened. bye-bye. If I can be excused a minute, there's no taper here. Years ago, I was invited to speak at the International Young People's Conference in Houston, Texas. And when we got down there, it was a fairly big conference. Maybe there's a couple of thousand people there. And I was a Friday night speaker, and I get up there, and I know most of the front row. There are people I'd met across the country, and I know them all, and we'd been active in AA and young people's things and that sort of thing. And I'm not paying a whole lot of attention, but they all had poster boards in front of them, just plain white poster boards, what I can see. And they go through the rigmarole to get the meeting started, and then they finally introduce me as the first speaker, and I get up and I say, hi, I'm Gary, and I'm an alcoholic. And they all turn the cards around on them, and there's a big F-U on every one of them. Now, that will mess with your talk. It really won't. But that started a routine of pulling tricks on the speakers as a bunch of us went around and were doing this. One day later on, Dick Grant was talking at the Kansas State Convention. And he got up and he introduced himself, and about 75 people got up and walked out. And all Dick said was, gee, I wish I'd have thought of that. And anyway, I white-knuckled it through those 4 years. I can tell how it was. I'd go to AA meetings, and two things I remember. Many meetings I went down and made coffee for, and nobody showed up. And so I'd take my books down and I would study and do my best. And I'd look out the window at the Buffalo Bar across the street. Buffalo Bar had those neon lights that would blink on and off. Buffalo, Buffalo. This one was missing the B. Said Uffalo, Uffalo. And I'd grab the arm of my chair and my knuckles would turn white. And I'd say, please, God, don't let me take a drink. I don't want a drink. Help me through this. And I did that any number of nights during that next 3 years. And the people that came to the AA meetings, I don't remember anybody mentioning the book Alcoholics Anonymous other than reading the first portion of the fifth chapter. And the only thing I heard about steps was an old boy named Frank got up, and he had been in and out of that meeting a million times. And this time he'd been sober for 6 months. And one night he says, well, what I think is different this time is I took the third step, and I haven't had any trouble since. So I think the third step is the answer. And the next Saturday, Frank came down drunk. And I said, I'm not screwing with that third step. <clears throat> Finished school. I did 4 years of college and three because I couldn't stand to be alone. Don't give me a vacation. I worked part-time. I did everything I could do there to stay busy. I got decent grades in school, which really surprised Dad. He says, I thought maybe you were just stupid. And he says, well, maybe you weren't. I think I was just an alcoholic, Dad. There's nothing stupid about me. Might have been better had I been stupid. And took a job with an oil company and ended up in Denver. And I only had a job that lasted, 8-9 hours a day. And I didn't have studying to do. I didn't have classes to do. I didn't have any of those things. And so I started scrambling to AA meetings. And so I'd gone from 2 meetings a week to, 500, I guess. Just a huge amount of meetings in Denver at that time. And it's even worse now. But they're crowding 2,000, I think. So I'm going to some meetings. And I ended up at a meeting when I go to these meetings, I'm about the only young guy they're seeing in AA. There weren't many of us around. And people were saying, isn't it wonderful that you got a hold of this thing so young and didn't have to go through all the stuff that we went through. And I had a resentment about that for the longest time because I got to thinking, what the hell is left for me to do? I've nearly died out there. I can't do this again. I know I can't. With that, but I suspect they meant well, and I've taken the opportunity to educate a few of them when I've had the chance since. But I ran into another guy who wasn't real happy about that, and his wife threw us out of the house one day and said, you two are miserable. You need to go find another meeting. She said, go downtown to the Denver Young People's Group. I heard there's a bunch of young people. Go down and try that. But she was truly mad at us, and my friend Joe got all puffed up. He said, all right, Brown, let's go down there. He says, the babe's got to be better looking there anyway. And that's why we went. They were. I like to tell you that's only a part of it, so I hope that's true. But they talked different in there. They talked about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they talked about taking the 12 steps in order, which I thought was an interesting concept. I had been told by a lady that the reason they put numbers in front of those steps is so a dumb bastard like me would know which one to take next. But I don't think I really heard it. And they talked about it. And I made some really bright remarks that they shut me down in a hurry. I said, what the hell? Just take one. It doesn't matter which one it is. Little guy said, Lee. Lee says, you go ahead and try that if you want to. But if you find out it don't work, maybe you'll live long enough to come back to it. But our experience is you need to do it the way it says in the book. So I came back. Nobody really, I was sober longer than most of them. There weren't many of them in there over 4 years of sobriety. But they had something going I didn't have. They certainly had more knowledge about AA because of all the extra meetings they'd seen and been to and done that. And they got an idea from some Canadians that there may be, at that point, the Denver Young People's Group had a closed discussion meeting downtown at a storefront club not far from the Denver Post. And then they had a Sunday night speaker meeting up at the York Street Club, and it met in this ballroom. And the seating normally, like you guys are seated, it probably held maybe 50 people, but they'd cram 100 people in there. And I think you couldn't go in unless you could smoke 2 packs of cigarettes in an hour. Because if you got anything above this level, you couldn't see anything. You get down on your knees, it was pretty clear. But I think people came in there just to see who was going to come in next. And it was nuts. And it was great fun. And we had a wonderful time. And the format was where they were call-up meetings, and you'd have 3 people called up to talk and speak. It was just crazy. It was just crazy. And the young people stuck together. We didn't really realize at that point that we pretty much had to. Because as we were going to AA meetings in general back in the 60s, we felt really out of place in the AA meetings with the older members. You'd get a crack like they'd spilled more than we drank and all that. I found a two-word answer for that, and you can figure out what it was on your own. And it probably didn't help my popularity any in the meeting either. So we started one of these other meetings that we were going to have. We had to meet in homes. And the idea of what the Canadians taught us was to take a big book in there and open it up at the very front, start with the forwards, and they said, we're going to go through this book together, and any time it gives us a course of action to take, we'll take it. Anytime it asks us a question, we'll answer it. We're going to do this as thoroughly as we possibly can, as anally as we possibly can. And so that was our intent. We didn't have any gurus there to show us how to do it. All we heard was what Mac Cheater told us when he came down from Winnipeg. And so we started that, and we did just that. We started at the very beginning of the book, which I thought was novel, and we went on through it. And I went through the doctor's opinion again, and I got a better understanding of being powerless over alcohol. By this point in time, I did understand that. I did not understand anything about my unmanageability, obviously, or I wouldn't have been running around with white knuckles from doing that. Wouldn't have been doing that. I'd have learned something. What I learned, though, while we did that, is nowhere does my big book tell me I'm going to be able to manage my life. And not once does it promise me that. It promises me if I do what happened, my life will change because I found a manager. Capital M. And so we started in that process and we did it. And I'll just give you a few things that went on because we went through the doctor's opinion and Bill's story and there's a solution. And then we got into chapter 3 that he read tonight. And the day that we read that line that was read earlier, that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics, this is the first step to recovery. The delusion or anything like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. I don't know why. Intellectually, I can't explain it. But when that got read that night, it's like I was given the keys to the kingdom. At that point, I understand that all these things I was going to try to do, I was trying to manage my life, and it was failing miserably. Don't take the first drink. You won't get drunk. I don't know why I didn't drink, but I knew that didn't work. Not drinking, me making promises not to drink never worked. It never did. And doing all these things that I'm going to do, I'm going to take the third step every day. Any of those things, I'm trying to manage my life, and the book very clearly said I can't manage it. The alcoholic at certain times has no mental defense against that first drink. And I believed it. And I think that's why I ended up with the keys to the kingdom. I finally got a handle on what being powerless and unmanageable is. We got to reading in the fourth chapter, we agnostics. And I see that as a second step discussion. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I didn't have much trouble with that because I understood the kind of insanity I had was alcoholic insanity. And if you're a real alcoholic in this room, the craziest thing you did stone sober. Didn't you? You took the first drink. We would take the first drink with all that experience behind us of what happens when we drink. And there's very few times we drank that it wasn't a disaster. And we take that first drink anyway. Now that's nuts. Yeah. Just not playing with a full deck. And I caught on to that. It's talking about alcoholic insanity. Now it may have more meaning to that because I made that remark to an old boy in Louisville a few years ago, and he said, oh, Gary, I think it means we can be restored to wholeness. And I said, Carter, I was never whole. I don't know what you're talking about. Your kind of drinking and mine was different. You may have had a period of time when you drank socially and you had a healthy whole life, but I don't relate to that. There's a jitter joint in Indianapolis called Fairbanks Hospital, and they're running commercials on TV there. It says, get your old life back. You know any alcoholic that wants to get sober that wants their old life back? One of the guys named Tom showed up at the young people's group right then about this time, and he helped me to see the second step, the concept of it. And Tom told the time when he was 19 years old, he got locked in a psychiatric center in Denver called Mount Airy. Very expensive psychiatric center, and it's still there. I think Mount Airy is a wonderful name for a nut house, don't you? Mount Airy for the airheads. And their treatment program was the aversion treatment. And those of you who aren't familiar with the aversion treatment, it is a medieval thing that still goes on today. And it was done in some hospital setting. And the treatment room in the hospital was just a room, maybe 15, 20 feet square. And the walls were shelved and they were mirrored. There were mirrors and shelves attached to the mirrors. And on the shelves were all the different kinds of liquor you'd ever want. And they'd given Tom some man abuse or something and take him into the treatment room and sat him in the chair. At the barber chair in the middle of the room had a stainless steel pot that had swiveled away from or part in front of who was sitting there. And they gave him the anabuse, and they told him he could have anything he wanted to drink. And, of course, he could sit there and look at the mirror and watch himself get violently ill. He could puke all he wanted, watch his toenails curl, his hair fall out, and go all through that. And the whole idea of that is after that was over, you'd be so averse to it, you'd never take another drink. And when he came to us a couple years later at Young People's, he said that it worked, it really had, that he'd not had reason or excuse to take anabuse since. But you understand that Tom went back out and drank. Isn't that nuts? Isn't that the insanity of alcoholism? Obviously, no human power can take care of that. It hadn't for him. We got to reading on in the fifth chapter, and we read about the actor. And we're kind of getting down to it. And Little Lee, that little wise guy that would talk to me about... One time I made the remark that the way I interpreted a phrase in the big book, and he said, "Gary, we don't much care." He said it clearer than that, but we don't much care how you interpret that. Let's get the black print on the white page. So this time he said he had an idea. He said he wanted to for us to join hands and read/pray the third step prayer together. The reason he had wanted to do that, and he had been to several meetings earlier in the last couple of weeks where they were four-step discussions, and he'd go ask people after the meetings why they hadn't written an inventory. Many of them said it was because they hadn't taken the third step. And Lee says, "I want to take a third step as a group here because if a week or two from now you hear me telling somebody I can't write an inventory because I haven't taken a third step yet, you can call me a damn liar because you saw me do it." And we understood that kind of logic. And so at that point in time, 14 men joined hands. Now, we started out as a co-ed group, and there might have been 20, 25 of us. But the girls left, and I don't know why. I didn't do it. And we did that. We joined hands and prayed the third step prayer together. And I did it because everybody else did. I didn't want to be the odd man out. I'd been the odd man out all my life. And... when it was over, we all left. And on the way home, I said another prayer. And I said, "God, I'm so sick of this. Please make that prayer work. Please give me some help." Time I got home, I knew I had something going for me. I had some kind of momentum. I didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something there. I love telling that story because there were 14 men did that third step prayer together that night. All of us have either died sober or we are still sober. We did that, and I think it was in 1970. The 14th guy, Eddie, went out within a week or two after we did that and drank and froze to death. But the other 13 of us got to the point where one of us took AA to Russia as a trustee for the General Service Office. And others have gone out, and we knew we had something going in terms of this getting a group of people and going through the book and doing what it says. Because we found an answer, and we've gone out and done that around A. Some of us are still on the circuit out talking, and those of us that can. And we've lost a few of us. And it's touched a whole lot of lives. There was something magic in that. We didn't have a guru there to show us how to do it, but something happened. And Don and I, the fellow that took it to Russia, for those of you who don't know him, we talked about what made us so special that happened to us. And the answer was absolutely nothing. We were 14 losers there that didn't deserve a goddamn thing. And we were blessed beyond anything we ever knew, and it's touched a lot of lives since. Isn't that crazy? We're looking at inventory. One of the guys in the group disappears. His name's Ernie. Ernie's a big, good-looking Mexican. And Didn't like him much, but that's not unusual in Cheyenne and Denver back in the 60s. We didn't like each other much. It wasn't a big deal. And we go to the young people's group, and of course it's late 60s, early 70s, and it's the time of the hippies and free love, and everybody's hugging one another, and you'd go into the AA meetings, and all that would be going on. But Ernie and I would just see each other across the room and give each other the peace sign. That was as close as we're getting to each other. He missed his finger. That's the only part of the reason I didn't like him. I learned later that I think the other part of the reason I didn't like him is I remember sitting in the York Street Club one day when Ernie walked in, and the girls next to me said, "Gee, when Ernie walks in, it just takes my breath away." I thought that. But we're supposed to be writing inventory and things are going on. But Ernie disappeared. And people would say, "Where's Ernie?" And I said, "Don't knock it. He's gone." Whatever it was, two or three weeks later, he showed up. And he walked into the meeting. And you could look him in the eye, and there was somebody home. And I swear I'd never seen anybody there before. He had changed. And it was visible he had changed. And when it came his turn to talk, he shared that he'd gotten a beef with his wife and he'd run away from home. And he'd gone down to Lake Whitney, Texas and hung around with an alcoholic down there named Bob White. Bob had put him in a little fishing cabin down on the lake and gave him a big book and a pad and a pencil. And he sat with him for a while and showed him how to write inventory and then left him in there. And other than getting out to eat and go to the bathroom, Ernie spent the whole 2 days in there, and he came out and told Bob he was done. Bob picked up the book and the pad and paper, and we walked down to the boat, and he said, "Let's go fishing." And they got out in the middle of Lake Whitney in the big boat, and out there, and Bob turned the boat off and sat there, and he says to Ernie, "Let's talk about what was in that inventory of yours." And Ernie can't swim, so he took a fifth step. That's the truest statement you're going to hear. Ernie can't swim, and that's the only reason he talked about it. And he took his fifth step, and then when he came home, there was something different. And that night, after that meeting, I went home and got my pad and my pencil and my big book out, and I started writing inventory. I figure I got home from the meeting at about 10 o'clock at night, and I know it was sun up the next morning, maybe 5 or 6 in the morning, and I stopped writing because I didn't have anything else to write. There wasn't anything else to put down. And I did my very best to follow the big book and the outline it had in there. I didn't really have anybody showing me how to do it at that time. And I wrote, I don't know how many inventories later, I have no idea. Many, many, many. That first inventory was probably the worst inventory I've ever written. And all it did was save my ass. It saved me my life, and it worked. And I ended up at a little conference in Southeast Colorado, and I had a room with Ernie. Five of us had ridden down there in a car together, four guys and a gal, and three guys and a gal. You can't get lost going from Denver to Lamar unless you're riding in the car and Ernie's driving, and we got lost. So we get there late, and there's only two rooms left, which means we got to share rooms. And I had high hopes I was going to share it with Mary, but I get Ernie. And he knows I have that inventory. And so he leans on me to take a fifth step with him. Or just take a fifth step. He didn't care who I took it with. He says, "You're around some of the finest sobriety in the state. Look around and get them. Most of them have listened to fifth steps and know what they're doing." And the truth was, I didn't like anybody else there any better than I did him. And so I took a fifth step with him. And we spent all that one afternoon. And the following morning, they asked me to be the Sunday morning speaker, because the real speaker didn't show up. And so I told my story to this point. A lady came up to me after the meeting, and she said, "Gary, that was a pretty good talk." She said, "I've known you since you came to Denver." And I said, "Yeah, Lynn, I think that's right." She said, "There was something different about your talk." And she started to leave, and she snapped a finger and turned around, and she said, "This time you told the truth, didn't you?" She's absolutely right. That's what had happened. The hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it began to grow shut that night. I promise you it did. And it worked pretty well. And I got fired from my last, I was getting fired from jobs as quick sober as I had from drunk. I got fired from that last job I had about a month after I'd taken that fifth step. I tried to explain to them that I've been doing this inventory stuff and working fifth steps and all that. And they said, that's fine, Gary, but you aren't doing the damn job. And I got recruited into a business I never would have looked for a job. Never, the last thing in the world that I wanted to do, and I was good at it. And ended up being a 50% owner of business. And things went well. And that group of us that went through the steps together tried everything we could do. And I wish I had time to tell you all about it, but there's a couple more important things I want to do. But we hung together. We were accountable to each other. And we just were. And if one of us had a 10th step resentment, we took the big book and we called one of the other ones immediately. There are words in the 10th step called at once, immediately, right away. I would say those are the action words, wouldn't you? And so we held each other accountable, and we did that. And we had some of the freest times of our lives. The business I had was going well, but I couldn't get along with my partner. And it got miserable. I wasn't making any headway. And any number of times I'd call Don and 10th step resentment I had at my partner. And he'd come out, sit outside the door so I could go in and make amends to her, because they'd just get noises all getting out. And I got a call from a guy in Nashville, Tennessee one morning. He said, I don't know why I'm calling you. It was the morning after Julie and I prayed what to do about the business is what it was. And I'd known Don for years. He was one of the early people in the Young People's Movement. He says, I don't know why I'm calling you, but I got this urge to call you during my quiet time, and the only reason I can think of is I need somebody to move out here and be a salesman for us in the Midwest. And Julie and I had prayed the night before, and we thought, do you think that's an answer to prayer? And her answer was, it sure beats hell out of a bolt of lightning. And so we moved to Indianapolis, and I did that. And I went into a town, a Midwestern town, that had maybe 50 meetings a week. Most of them were speaker meetings. I'm the new guy in town, and I'll talk. And so I shared my experience of going through the book and the steps with other people. Most of them were speaker meetings. So everywhere I went, I shared that experience. And 3 years later, a redneck in there says, Gary, I want to start one of those meetings like you guys had. And he says, it's going to be at my house, and it's going to be 7:30 Thursday. Will you be there? And I said, sure. And so I went through the process. We started with 14 guys and finished with 13. And those guys did all, and effectively they did the same thing, but they kept it in the Indianapolis area. They went out and got other people and took them through the book and the steps in order. Today you go to the Indianapolis metro area and you can listen about every meeting in there, and somebody's going to talk about the workshop they're in going through the big book and the steps. I talked Saturday night before I left town at a meeting, and there were a lot of people in there that had been through workshops. And I asked them, on any given week, how many workshops do you think are going on in Indianapolis? And they guessed from 20 to 50. It's like, hey, nobody's keeping score, but it's taken off from that. And we found a way to get the 12 steps to people and get their lives to change, and it works. It really works. The only thing was, is I wasn't paying attention. I was helping people thinking I'm a guru, but I'm chipping on my wife. I'm having trouble making a living. And my friends in AA are ignoring me. I'm learning a hard, hard lesson. I'm learning that as an AA member trying to live a spiritual life, I can't tell a lie in one part of my life without it affecting my entire life. In other words, I was lying about my sex life. And next thing you know is I couldn't make a living. It was affecting my financial life. My social life was going to pot because my best buddies in AA were steering clear of me. They knew what I was doing, knew I was out of line. They were afraid to say anything to me. So my whole life was crumbling, and it really was. And I got into some serious trouble, some really serious trouble. It got so bad that I called a man in Chicago named Paul Martin, who today is 60 years sober. I'd known him for a long time, and I'd always had respect for him. But he is probably the step Nazi of all step Nazis. He's wonderful. He's one of the early guys in AA. His first sponsor was a fellow named Tom Powers, who edited the 12 and 12 for Bill. And his life changed dramatically. And he has always found that taking the steps work, and they work real well. And later on, he got to talking with other people, and he found out if he took a lot of fifth steps, it worked even better. And so he started doing that. And so the kind of thing he was sponsored about. So I remember I'm in so much trouble. I call him one day, and I said, Paul, is there any possibility that a 40, whatever I was, 2 or 3 year old alcoholic with 20 years of sobriety could be going through male menopause? And he said, well, maybe. He says, but my guess is if you'll review the first 3 steps again, write another inventory, come up here and take some fifth steps, make some amends, your life will change. And I told him I'd do that. And by the following Friday, I had another inventory written. And I've been writing inventories every time I took through the people through the steps. I didn't just teach them how. I had stuff to share. And I wrote another inventory, and the resentment list was brand new. I didn't cover any old ground in it. I didn't repeat anything I had inventoried before. The fear list, for the most part, was brand new. But I did, in the conduct inventory, I went all the way back through my life. And I tried not to miss anything or anybody. And I asked the 9 questions on every one of them. And so it was cumbersome, but I got it done. And I called him, and he told me that I was done. And he said, be in LaGrange at 4 o'clock. Told me where the motel was I was to be. I got there early enough to go get a cup of coffee. There's a knock at the door. And I answer the door, and there's a stranger standing there. And he says, my name is Dennis O'Brien. I'm 29 years sober. I'm here to swap fifth steps with you. He walks in the door with a three-ring binder, and he sits down in the only damn chair in the motel room and opens a three-ring binder and starts reading inventory for me. He tells me, he says, I'm going to go first so you know what to do. And he reads inventory to me. And he's like me. He's written lots of inventories, and he's good at it. He can write an inventory and omit the drama to get down to where he was at fault, how it affected his self-esteem, his ambitions, his pocketbooks, his sex life. Where had he been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or frightened? And he could just do it. And it didn't take him long. And it was my turn, and I did. And it didn't take me long for that same reason. And we compared the notes because I'd caught stuff he'd missed, and he caught stuff I'd missed. And he left. I go get a cup of coffee. Get back. There's a knock at the door. The guy says, I'm Chuck. I'm 21 years sober. I'm here to swap fifth steps with you. I'll go first so you know what to do. By noon Sunday, I'd done that 9 times. I'd been invited to lunch with the guys. I think it's over. And at that point, Paul was 38 years sober, 37, down to guys 2 or 3 years sober, but who had done the work, had been making amends. They knew what was going on. And so I'm sitting there with these guys talking about this, thinking it's over. And one of them said, Gary, get your pad and pencil out. We'll help you with your amends list. And they had really good memories. Then they said, are there any amends you owe that, to people that aren't on that inventory? And I said, of course, with that. And we went down through there. And they couldn't believe I had stayed sober with that little of a program. That all I'd done is written lots of fourth and fifth stems, but had never cleaned up any of the wreckage of my past. They just couldn't believe it. How the hell did you do that? But the only answer could have been was working with other people like I'd been, or dumb luck. In either case, I'm not going with that anymore. I go home and I sit down with Julie and we go through the amends list. And we owed a great deal of money. We just owed more and more money than you can imagine. I only got time to tell you about a little bit of this. I set up a huge columnar pad to pay them off. And I'd write the check down every payday till it was nothing left but gas money and grocery money and be broke to payday. And we did it and did it and did it. Julie felt the amends were as much hers as mine. She was with me most of the time when I was out borrowing money from parents or AA members or whoever it was. And so she was all for us taking care of that. So I come down one day after fighting this, and I said, Julie, I'm never going to be able to make enough money to do this. It's never going to happen. I can't do it. I don't see how it's going to happen. And she was a black belt, big book, Al-Anon, and she didn't offer one damn bit of sympathy. The next morning, she said she had an idea. And her idea was that, you know, we'd been in that same house for a about 11 years, and I'd had the same jobs for 11 years, which I think was my record tenure at any job. And I had all this 401k retirement money, and we had equity in the house. She said, we can sell the house, cash in the equity on that, and we could cash in all your retirement. We could pay off all those amends, maybe some current debt, and there'd be enough left that we could buy a used trailer house. And I thought, she can't be serious. My God, she can't be serious. And I knew she was. So I come home from work that night, and I said, let's call Paul and see what he says. I needed an out. And I called him, and I said, Paul, you've known me for 20 years. You've always known I'm crazy. Try this on. Well, we're talking about selling the house and cashing in return and making all those amends and buying a trailer house to live in. I said, how local does that sound? He said, Gary, I've known you 20 years, and that's the sanest thing I've ever heard you say. He said, was it your idea? And I said, no, it was Julie's, and he said he thought so. And so we listed the house. That call was made in September. The house sold on the 28th of February, the following February, which happened to be Julie's belly button birthday. She was 39 again. And that was the greatest day of our lives. We paid off some bills you wouldn't believe. It wouldn't happen. And I'm just going to tell you about a couple of them because I got about 2 minutes to do it. And one of them was to a guy in AA who had come and saved my life. He liked me. We had met at that Young People's Conference in Houston years before that. And he liked us, and he's still out there in the circuit today. And he stopped by to see us on his way to another conference one day. And I meet him at the airport, and he looks me in the eye, and he said, you look terrible. He was more clear than that. He said, I look like something. And what's going on? And I told him about what I'd been doing in my life and all of that I hadn't told anybody about. And I says, the worst thing is they're going to foreclose on the house tomorrow, and Julie doesn't know a thing about it, and I'm afraid it'll kill her. And I felt better because I'd finally told somebody. We get in the car, and we start out to my house, and you drive past downtown on I-70, and he says, where's your bank? And I said, what bank? He says, the one that has a note on your house. I said, no, that's over here downtown. He said, let's go see him, have a talk. I says, Bob, they don't want talk. They're really tired of talk. Trust me, we don't need to talk. So you never know. So we parked the car, and I'm walking across the street with him to go into that bank, and I felt like those times when I was a kid going in to see the principal with my dad. And the talk goes like this. He walks in, sits down, and he's looking at a very angry banker that's got a file folder that full of very legal-looking stuff. And Bob says, how much does it take to get Gary caught up on his payments? And the guy opened the folder and gave him a number, and Bob reached in his pocket, and he peeled it off in cash and traveler's check. And I walked out of there, and he just paid back several thousand dollars in house payment. And I'm stunned, and I'm walking to the car, and I said, Bob, I got to pay that back. He said, that's your problem. Okay, flash forward several months now. We sell the house. I call Bob, tell him I got the money. And I said, you know, here's the money, and he laughs. I said, give me your address. He laughs again. I said, what's so funny? And he says, well, cowboy, it's like this. When I helped you with that house, I had a business that made money faster than I could spend it. I really did. He said, Linda and I were always looking for ways to tithe. I traveled the country a lot talking. And one of the ways we would tithe is we would find people that needed help. And he says, I helped you and I helped a lot of other people around by doing it. It's just crazy. Since then, Congress has changed the laws. And you can't do the investment gains with real estate or cattle or oil wells or whatever it is they used to do. And he says, I got all these apartment houses around the country that aren't making a dime. I got investors after me. I'm living on allowance. It's been awful. He says, I don't tell anybody in AA that other than my sponsor, and I talk to Don every day of the week about it just to make sure I'm telling the truth when what's going on. And he says, you know, the craziest thing is happening. He says, I'll go down to the post office now and get the mail. And every week now for the last few weeks, a couple days a week, there's been a check in the mail. And this money has started coming back in. He says, honest to God, I haven't asked anybody for a dime of it. And I believed him because I had been a part of that deal. And I'd been a part of a very big deal. And I was learning that this AA program is huge. It's a whole lot more than my little self and my little meeting and all these bastards doing everything wrong. It has nothing to do with that. This is a big deal, and it's all about caring for the other guy. And that's the hardest things for us to understand and to find out is that's what it was. We made amends to our parents, and that's a whole other story. We made amends for things we've done clear back to our childhood. And we moved into the trailer house, and I loved it. You know how you winterize a trailer house? You crawl under it back that far, and you pick up this funny-looking extension cord, and you plug it in. And you're done. You're by God done. And we lived there for, I think it was 4 years. And it was fine, and things started going better for us and all that, and then we bought a house, and now we're on the second house since that one. And our lives have changed, and the grandbabies have grown up, and they're all in their 20s, and one out of the five is in our kind of trouble, only has diabetes too, and the drinking and the crack, and I'm surprised he's lived this long. He's 28, and if he makes it to 30, it'll be a miracle. And we got the two little girls. He sired one of them, and somebody else sired the other one, but they're half-sisters, and my daughter adopted them both. And they call us Poppy and Grandmother. I don't know where she got all the class. I'm Poppy. Keep telling her she's had it made for nearly 50 years. AA has been a part of my life. I fell in this deal about the time I hit the young people's group in Denver, and I fell in love with it. And to this day, at 49 or 43 years sober, I love everything I do. I loved being at the prison with Pete yesterday. The greatest meetings you can go to are the ones at the clang in front when you go in and the clang when you leave when you get out. The clang when you're going out is better. Thanks for having me.